Hope everybody's a little bit refreshed. It's not as good as a 15-minute break and a cup of coffee, but hopefully it does you a little bit. It's my great pleasure to introduce Norm Elstrand. He's a professor of genetics from the University of California in Riverside, California. I met Norm when he was finishing up his PhD at the University of Texas at Austin, where he's evolutionary, that did work in the evolution of plants, and he's still very interested in the evolution of plants. He's been involved in this question of gene flow and its consequences for many years. As you all know, this problem with wild rice and genetic engineering hinges around the question of gene flow. If wild rice is going to get contaminated by some other genetic sources, the genes have to move. And this is an area that Norm has been studying now for, several decades. I would say he's one of the world's experts on this, especially in its application to GMOs, where he's been involved in a number of very interesting and controversial cases, which if you get to have dinner with him later tonight, he can tell you more about those controversies. But he's here to talk to us about gene flow and its consequences. Thank you, Norm.
Thank you, David, for that kind introduction, and thank you for inviting me. In fact, I'm very flattered that Dave invited me to this conference. Dave and I bump into each other in different countries around the world about every other year, so he's a colleague that I hold in high respect, and when he told me about this particular conference, I got really excited. And in fact, I'm very humbled to come too, because the information that I've received over the last 2 days is just massive and reminds me how little I know as a scientist. So I thank everybody here for broadening my mind, opening my mind, making me look at the world in different ways. Talking to Mr. Kingbird yesterday, he gave me some advice. He said, speak the truth. So before I go into the talk, I want to speak the truth about this conference. It seems to me that this is a very important conference. Around the world, people are beginning to recognize, well, there's some anxiety people are having now about being connected to their food. Food has been very commercialized, it's been industrialized, and the source of food is getting further and further away from people. And this is marked by the fact that in the last few years, for the first time in human history, the majority of people in the world do not produce their own food. It's now more than 50% of the people live in urban areas, and they are estranged from their food. So there's a lot of anxiety about food production, and throughout the world, people are beginning to identify that food is, in fact, very important. This conference is the first one of its kind that I know about that brings together people who understand the value of food very deeply with scholars who study food in a variety of different ways. And I think that this is very important. This marks the coming together and the mutual education. I think that this conference could serve as a model for anxiety, for addressing the anxieties that people have about their individual special foods throughout the world. So I'm aware that the indigenous people of Hawaii are very interested in taro and its future. The point that brought them to that was genetic engineering. In southern Mexico, the indigenous farmers and farmers of Spanish descent, for that matter, are very anxious about preserving the diversity of maize land races there, which are endangered for a variety of reasons. Again, the spear tip, the point of the pin that burst the balloon and made things happen, was genetic engineering, but this brings to the fore other issues as well. So I want you all to carry with you the fact that you're participating in something that historically could be very important, and this could serve as a model for other peoples around the world. Okay, my talk is going to be about gene flow and its consequences, and the obvious gorilla in the room is, what are the implications for transgene flow, that is, the flow of engineered genes out of engineered crops into places where we don't desire them to be. I'm going to give you a little bit of basics about gene flow. For many of you in the room, this may be something you already know, but it sort of will serve to get our heads around the issue of gene flow and dispersal. I'll talk about possible consequences of crop-to-wild gene flow using real-life examples from traditionally improved crops, not genetically engineered crops. I'm going to touch very briefly on the population genetics that talks about when we might predict these particular consequences might occur. Although there are many stories, I'll tell you just one story of unintended transgene flow to give you an example of what's happened. I'll wrap it up with what, for me, I think this all means. Gene flow is one of the four evolutionary forces. It's defined as a gene frequency change in a population due to successful immigration of individuals or gametes. Generally, gene flow tends to homogenize populations. So we've got two corn populations here with different genotypes. In the upper left-hand corner, we've got the smiley genotype, and in the lower right-hand corner, we have the rather taciturn genotype. So let's have a little gene flow here. We'll have some dispersal. And look at those populations. Aren't they becoming homogenized? Yes. So they look a lot more like each other now than they did in the beginning. In evolutionary sense, we have to let these guys mate with each other and have babies, and we'll assume that the babies look identical to what we see here. Now we have a full generation, and we can say that gene flow has occurred, that each population has evolved, and it's evolved to become, in this case, more diverse and more homogeneous with the other population. That's what gene flow is. Some other things to think about gene flow: it can be unilateral, so you can think of gene flow as being from a source to a sink population. Europeans moving to North America would be unilateral, mostly. It could be bilateral, with genes flowing in opposite directions over time, so you could have two fields of corn. The wind blows one way one day, and it delivers pollen from one population to the other. It blows the other way, and it goes back. So that could be bilateral. Gene flow could occur once. You could have a population of cultivated sunflowers growing next to wild sunflowers. The wild sunflowers might receive genes from the cultivated sunflowers for that one year. The farmer decides he doesn't want to plant sunflowers anymore, and that's a single batch of gene flow. The farmer, on the other hand, might decide they want to plant sunflowers for 10 years in a row, and you'd have recurrent gene flow into the wild population. And of course, if it is bilateral, it could be asymmetric. You could have a lot going one way and a little going the other way. Vehicles for plant gene flow, I used Monomin as an example. You can have whole plants or plant fragments moving. You can have seeds or fruits of plants moving from place to place. And I was able to get a picture of Monomin pollen. So there's some tiny Monomin pollen grains magnified, I don't know, a couple, well, certainly magnified there hundreds of times. And these are ways that the genes can disperse. They're dispersed within the organism, so are the gametes. Some of the vectors for plant gene flow: you can have wind. Dorothy's watching a little breeze here. You can have water, and you can have human activity on the, you know, soles of your shoes or in the parts of a combine. And there are other things you can think about. Mike brought up the issue of ducks. Where might crop genes flow? We could have genes flowing from a crop into natural populations of the same or closely related species. So sometimes we get gene flow within a species, gene flow between species that have some compatibility. Or you could have gene flow into the same or other varieties of the same crop. So you could have gene flow from one field of popcorn into another field of popcorn, or you could have gene flow from a field of popcorn into a field of corn intended for human consumption or animal consumption. How is gene flow traditionally managed? You might be surprised to hear that gene flow is managed, and it's managed by people who want to grow pure seed. In particular, plant seed companies want to, you know, if they're going to sell you a bag of radish seed and you're buying Cherry Bell radishes, they ought all be Cherry Bell and not long white daikons or short Spanish black radishes. So they have to have a certain level of purity. Sometimes physical barriers are used, like greenhouses, or glass houses. Sometimes there's a difference in timing so that they might plant their seeds at different times every couple of weeks so that they're flowering at different times and there isn't the opportunity for cross-pollination between types. Space is sometimes used as an isolating factor as well. This is a traditional gene flow curve of shows that amount of pollen drops off very rapidly with distance. And finally, there's barrier plants, people who want to grow a crop and keep a crop for seed production and want to keep the seed relatively pure, might put rows of corn around sorghum corn being taller, and that corn would tend to block the wind or capture sorghum pollen coming in from adjacent fields. So sometimes barrier plants can actually be used to reduce reduce the spatial factor. Okay, so what are some of the possible consequences of gene flow for the receiving population? There are more consequences than these four, but I chose these because I figured this is what the audience is interested in. These are real documented consequences from non-engineered domestic crops, where gene flow from a non-engineered domestic crop has had a consequence in natural populations. The first is changes in diversity. I'm talking very little about my research today, but the shocking pink examples up here, each of those species represents about 50,000 data points from my lab. These are some examples of what happens when crop populations are grown next to wild populations, and somebody samples the seeds from the wild population and compares it to wild populations that are distant from the crop population. And what we find is that there's an increase in diversity in those wild populations that are near crop populations. And first, this might seem shocking because a lot of people have raised the issue of depletion of diversity when a crop is near a wild population. But in fact, a crop tends to have some genes that may be rare in a wild population or absent in a wild population. And so the genes that flow into the wild population are increased in frequency, or the crop introduces some new genes to those populations. So it's not particularly surprising. The one exception that I found in the literature so far is a case of bean in Mexico, and I'll be glad to discuss why that particular population involves a decrease in diversity. Okay, and the implication then is that generally we'd expect crop gene flow to contribute to local genetic diversity, and of course it would, because a gene such as a gene from a jellyfish or a bacteria is not going to be in that wild population, so it would certainly be introducing a new gene. I think then that this issue of diversity becomes a red herring that detracts from some of the other consequences that are more important. Crop-to-wild gene flow sometimes, but I have to emphasize, rarely results in the evolution of new weeds or invasives. Now, given that I just said rarely, I have to say that those exceptions are real doozies, and the doosiest of the doozy is the wild beet in Europe. This is a spectacular weed which has cost the European sugar industry at least $1 billion over time. It's a hybrid between sugar beet and its wild relative sea beet, which is not particularly weedy. Hybridization occurs at the seed multiplication zones in the south of France. The sea beet occurs on the coast of France, and a few miles away are the seed multiplication plots for the sugar beet. The seed multiplication plots for sugar beet underwent a change when people decided that they would make hybrid beets. And to make a hybrid variety, then you have to have two varieties juxtaposed in alternating rows. One row is male fertile, the other row is male sterile. And since you can pull the seeds off the male sterile plants, and you know they didn't pollinate themselves, so they must have been pollinated by the male fertile plants, and that's how you get hybrid seeds, and that's how you make the farmers come back every year for more hybrid seed. The problem is that these male sterile plants are so lonely, they'll accept pollen not only from the intervening male fertile plants, but they'll also accept pollen that blows in from the Mediterranean. The pollen from the Mediterranean is the sea beet pollen. The sea beets are annuals, sugar beets are perennials, and annual doesn't do what a farmer wants. And the hybrids have then that annual bolting gene that causes the beet to behave rudely. So in Northern Europe, where they grow sugar beets for sugar, the farmers sowed out the seed, and 1 in 1,000 plants didn't set a sugar beet. Instead, it set a lump of wood the size of a sugar beet and shot up the stalk that flowers, mates with the 1 in 1,000 other stalks that are there, and the farmers are running out trying to rogue them all out, but can't do it because 1 in 1,000 is an awful lot of wild beets. And then once they've reseeded themselves, it becomes a problem over and over again because you don't identify the hybrids until it's too late, until they shoot up that stalk. So they reseed themselves, and for those farmers who don't rotate, this has become a tremendous hassle. And as we speak, there are sugar beet fields in Europe where the farmers are growing more weeds than they are sugar beets. How does it cause a problem for the industry? That lump of wood damages farm machinery. The bolting beets compete with the sugar beets, so they're taking, they're shading them, they're taking energy away from them. And finally, those lumps of wood get caught in the, are processed, thrown into the semi-trucks, taken to the sugar processing factory, where they damage the machinery there, and certainly they don't have any sugar in them. So it's been a hassle. These first evolved in France, and now they occur all the way from Ireland to the Ukraine, and it's a big deal. So that's the worst case, but it is a doozy. Implication is the transgene flow will sometimes result in new weeds and new invasives. Likewise, gene flow sometimes, but rarely, results in increased extinction risk. And there are about 8 cases where the wild relatives of cultivated crops have been put at risk of extinction because of gene flow with their cultivated types. In this case, what's happening is the cultivated type, so much gene flow occurs from the cultivated type to the wild type that the wild type becomes swamped out, and generation by generation, the wild type evolves into the cultivated type. So it's not an extinction where individuals go extinct. It's an extinction by sex, where one type replaces the other. The poster child in this case, the most extreme case, is wild coconut palm. Wild coconut palm was originally a pantropical species on small islands all around the world, as coconut palm pasta now. And that was the primary source in the Middle East of carbohydrates for people. That crop spontaneously hybridized with a goat grass relative, and that hybridization gave rise to a new species, the species that we call bread wheat. So that was, again, a case of spontaneous hybridization between a crop and a wild relative, and that gave rise to something that sustains hundreds of millions of people in the world today. So I don't want to say the gene flow in itself is good or bad. It's what we and our set of values decide to do with it. I think I will not spend a lot of time on the population genetics aspects unless there are geneticists in the crowd who want to know about this. But we can do some predicting of whether there will be these kinds of consequences based on the theory of population genetics. And if we know something about the size of the receiving population, whether gene flow is one time or recurrent, how the gene that we're worried about affects fitness of the receiving plant, and whether that gene is linked to another gene that has a strong fitness effect, then we can make some strong predictions about whether a new gene in a population, going from a crop to a wild population, whether that gene will persist, whether that gene will spread, or whether that gene will go extinct. And so we can go through the one gene expectations, can look at neutral genes, detrimental genes, and beneficial genes. A neutral gene will persist even after one batch of gene flow, but it will persist at the frequency at which it's introduced. Detrimental gene will decrease to extinction. A beneficial gene, if it's beneficial in the population where it arrives, will increase to 100%. We could do this again using recurrent gene flow, but I think I'll just allow this, you know, if there are questions about this, we'll go for it. We could also do this with multi-gene expectations, and in this case, one more thing to think about is the fact that reproductive system plays a very important role in whether or not persistence and spread occurs. Let's move on to engineered genes. So far, we've only talked about genes that are associated with traditional crops, engineered genes. It's been a hobby of mine to keep track of newsworthy cases where transgenes have flowed where they shouldn't. This is because when I first got involved in this in the late 80s, people told me transgenes were under strong control, that it would be to the disadvantage of companies to let them get out of place, and certainly they would never end up being out of place. Over the last 10 years, there are about 75 cases of gene flows and of transgenes ending up where they shouldn't. And I give you one example per year of some of these newsworthy cases. The one that we're going to talk about in detail is a 2004 report, the first report of spontaneous spread of regulated transgenes into wild populations. And what do we mean by regulated transgenes? We mean ones where a government has not said you can go ahead and commercialize this. So these would be genes being grown under field trial. This is based on three scientific papers. The work wasn't done in my lab, but I have a lot of interest in this. The player in this particular story is creeping bentgrass. Creeping bentgrass is a domesticated lawn plant. It is a domesticated golf course plant, and it occurs as a wild species around the northern hemisphere. The particular player in this story is called the million-dollar grass. Why is it called the million-dollar grass? Creeping bentgrass has been genetically engineered with a bacterial gene for resistance to the herbicide glyphosate. Glyphosate is an herbicide that's very benign to humans and most higher organisms, but it kills all plants. So it's if you could genetically engineer a plant to be resistant to glyphosate, to Roundup, then if you sprayed the plant, all other plants would die, and you could get a nice uniform stand. And for putting greens, Scotts and Monsanto companies decided that it would be really cool to have a uniform stand of a single species so that you could spray the herbicide, it would be all bent grass, and that little blade of fescue would never come up to divert Tiger Woods' putt and lose him $1 million. So that's why they call it the million-dollar grass. They were so excited about commercializing this plant that they asked for a special field trial permit so that farmers could multiply the seed under field trial before it was deregulated. And they anticipated that it would be deregulated within 12 months after the field trial, so there really wouldn't be any problem. So instead of having a tiny field trial, the way that most field trials are done in the United States, they asked for this control district, a control district of about 100 square miles, and embedded within the control district And this is in eastern Oregon where there's a lot of seed multiplication done. Okay, so it's dry during the summer. You can lay the seeds out, let them dry out. Farmers know how to multiply seed of all kinds of things. So this seemed like the ideal location. The reason that they had a big control district instead of having a single field trial for each farmer was that then there was no way that Greenpeace would come and bother farmers dressed up like bentgrass, right? So this is what was set up. There were over 100 farmers within there who were multiplying the bentgrass. Lydia Wattrid, who's in Western Oregon at EPA, was skeptical of this plan, and she decided she would sample seeds from outside of the control district to see if the glyphosate-resistant gene showed up in any of the wild populations. She sampled from wild Agrestis stolonifera, wild creeping bentgrass. She sampled from red top, which is a related Agrestis species and is considered a pretty nasty weed, and she put out sentinel plants in pots just in case they would pick up something that wouldn't be picked up otherwise. The map that you see here, every red dot represents a location where seeds were set by plants that had glyphosate resistance. So it's pretty easy. She went out, collected seeds, took them back to Western Oregon, germinated them, and because all plants die from glyphosate, except those that are genetically engineered, when she sprayed her germinated plants, the ones that survived had the gene. And she actually went ahead and snipped the gene out and used molecular genetics to confirm that the engineered gene was in those plants. This is particularly exciting to me as a gene flow scientist because this particular study represents the most distant gene flow by pollen ever recorded by mankind. The greatest distance, just under 24 kilometers, is about 13 miles. That's the distance that the grass pollen went from the farmer's field to the plant. And indeed, it probably went further because she measured from the edge of the control district as opposed to measuring from the middle of the control district. So that's pretty exciting. There were some follow-up studies done because people sometimes say, who haven't studied transgenic plants, that, well, gosh, a transgene is so artificial it's not going to persist in populations. It's really makes it sort of a geeky plant, and geeky plants aren't going to survive. The two follow-up studies were done, both one on the outside found plants, the ones in yellow, are the spots in yellow, were plants that were still surviving in 2006, as well as a study within the control area which found plants in 2008. And the both studies were able to compare to the original frequencies that Wattrid came up with and found an increase in frequency over time. Now, the increase in frequency is particularly interesting because Scotts and Monsanto would be breaking the law if they allowed this gene to persist when it's still regulated. So every year, Scotts and Monsanto sends out teams of people to kill every free living Brent grass plant they can find, paying them minimum wage, I imagine. And still, the frequency of the gene is increasing in those populations. So we come back to this list. Now, the risks of gene flow associated with transgenic plants is often listed as an environmental risk. And I would contend that none of these notable events truly have affected the environment in a in the sort of negative way that, say, a pollutant would affect the environment. But I would contend that there's still consequences. And the consequences are sort of help us focus on what it all means. In some cases, there has to be substitution of using old herbicides because we can't use glyphosate on the glyphosate-resistant plants. This has hurt trade between the United States and other countries. I'm talking about all 75 events now. I'm summarizing the consequences, no longer just talking about the bent grass. Farmers who are trying to sell to GM free markets have been hurt by this. I'm sure many of you have heard about the Liberty Link rice genes getting into the United States rice supply. There are big lawsuits associated with this going on right now. There is an issue that I found when I was working in Mexico on regulatory sovereignty that certain countries that will go nameless claiming that, well, if it's been deregulated in this country, how come third world countries won't accept it? Because after all, we've got the best regulatory system in the world and everybody else should just accept it too. So there's those kinds of conflicts going on. Unease about coexistence in the state of California. I've participated in the California Coexistence Group, which seeks to work out ways of having coexistence between genetically engineered crops and other crops of the same species. And they're working towards building maps of notification so that if you want to grow organic, then you can go to the go online, find the map, find who your neighbor is who grows genetically engineered stuff, call them on the phone, have some sort of discussion about how you're going to work it out. Fear of farm crops. Probably most of you have heard that some genetically engineered crops have been created for the purpose of creating pharmaceuticals. Farmers in Iowa who are perfectly comfortable growing millions of acres of genetically engineered corn are not at all comfortable with having neighbors who are growing crops that are genetically engineered for pharmaceutical compounds, should those pharmaceutical compounds get into the human or animal food and feed supply. So farm crops is a particularly important issue. Security of intellectual property, and this pertains to the people who are making the genetically engineered crops. They're worried that GeneFlow is going to deliver their seed or pollen, their genes into the hands of people they don't want it in. Liability, other legal issues. And finally, it's important for the ag biotech industry to worry about GeneFlow because it's created so much bad press for them. So these are all sort of the consequences that I was able to pull off the top of my head. So I've given you the basics of GeneFlow. I've talked about the possible consequences and given you real-life examples coming from traditional crops, so we can learn some good lessons from traditional crops and looking to history. I told you that the rules of population genetics can give us some reasonable predictors on when those consequences might occur so that people could make mindful decisions about which crops to develop for genetic engineering and which ones not to develop. I gave you one example of many of transgenes out of hand. I tried to choose an example that was relevant to Manoman. And what it all means, in my eyes, social scientists, humanists have to link arms with people who have traditional knowledge, people who have scholars with life science knowledge, physical science knowledge. We all have to share together because these are not questions that can be restricted only to life science or environmental science. So, I hope I can say it right. Miigwech, thank you. I'd like to thank Manoman for bringing us all together. I'd like to thank our symposium hosts, particularly the White Earth Reservation and the University of Minnesota for making this possible. I have to thank my funding over the years. Most of my GeneFlow funding has come from the United States Department of Agriculture, BRAR grants, and a large grant from the National Science Foundation. And finally, no research lab is an individual. All research labs, it takes a village to make research. And my village is up here. These are the members of Team Elstrand, crop gene flow scientists who have contributed millions of data points and much wisdom to my laboratory over the years. I wouldn't be here without them. Thank you very much.